compelling music of poetry.
The sounds, the rhythms, the way a line moves, that's the thing that drives the poems. I mean, I hear a music in my head, and the music teaches me where to go.
That's poet Catherine Levy. We talk with her about her latest poetry volume, Reports. Then we listen back to an extended excerpt from my 2008 interview with Mark Eleveld about the anthology and CD set he edited, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. This is the last week of Poetry Month 2018. We're fortunate to have as our first guest today poet Catherine Levy. I've known Catherine as a friend for several years. What I didn't know until I asked her for an interview about her work was just how wonderful a poet she is. Her most recent poetry volume is Reports, a finalist for the 2014 Midwest Book Award. Poet Rachel McKibben says of Reports, quote, "These poems embody grief and solitude with a masterful grace and ferocity, each webbed to the next with the immediacy of loss and the persistence of survival. Reports is a collection of incantations demanding its readers to break this world wide open, to testify, to live." I couldn't say it better. I spoke with Catherine Levy in March at her home in Sag Harbor, New York. Well, Catherine Levy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Welcome to my home, Francesca.
Yes, your lovely home here in Sag Harbor, New York. Now, before we get to talking about this latest poetry volume of yours, Reports, I just would like to ask you some questions about yourself as a poet. Like, when did you first start writing poetry?
I started writing when I was 9. Somebody came to our class to teach us how to write little verses. You know, I've spent years teaching poetry to children in the public schools. I would have never presented poetry the way this woman did, because she just showed us how we could create cute rhymes, and that's the opposite of what I try to do with children. But it didn't matter. I remember it. Of course, memory changes things in your mind, but I remember it as being an epiphany, as if somebody was explaining something to me that I had always known about but didn't have words for. And I started furiously writing then, and I never stopped.
Wow, when you say furiously writing, so every day?
Oh, yeah, every day. I mean, I used to stay up half the night writing from that moment on. And I did that. I mean, I've done that basically all my life. I mean, you know, when you're younger, you tend to write more because there's just this overflow of things that you need to write. And I was discovering it for the first time. But yeah, it became my life. I didn't even understand until I was 16 that most people don't write poetry. I thought everyone wrote poetry, that was just a given, and then you did all the other things, but that every single person in the world wrote poetry. It took me a while to wake up to the fact that wasn't true.
It was true at one time, but certainly hasn't been for a very long time in our culture.
That is true. Sure, Queen Elizabeth wrote beautiful poetry. Abraham Lincoln wrote poetry. Ordinary people wrote poetry. So I guess I was living in the past, or I was living in my dream world, which was pretty intense at that time.
So what did poetry do for you, and what does poetry do for you?
You know, I think that I fell in love with the music of it to begin with. And I'm still in love with that to this day. I have some poet friends who would hate my calling it the music of it. It's a vague, generic term for the sounds, the rhythms, the way a line moves. That's the thing I remember loving as a child for the first time. And for me, that's the thing that drives the poems. I mean, I hear a music in my head, and the music teaches me where to go. What does it do for me? It does everything for me, Francesca. When I'm not writing, I'm miserable. When I'm writing, the world feels more coherent, richer. I can see the complexity of life and embrace the complexity of life rather than being terrified by it. I feel strangely in control while I'm writing. And I have to say that I've taught a lot of inner city children, and I've taught prisoners, and I find that the same thing is true for them, that while they're writing, they have a kind of power and autonomy that they don't have in other aspects of their lives. I came from a very dysfunctional family. My mother was very disturbed. She was abusive. And when I was writing, I was all alone in my own world. And I felt that I transcended everything. And I do to this day. Now, I mean, there's also a way of thinking when I'm writing, a way of exploring consciousness, being, the world, that is much more profound than the way I think about things in my ordinary life. And I think that we have a tendency to get rather deadened by all the things that are coming at us all the time. And when I spend that contemplative time with my work, I think that I see things more clearly, with more generosity of spirit, more rigor at the same time. But I think that the thing that drove me at the beginning and drives me to this day is that hearing that music in my head.
And would you say that poetry does that more than prose? Maybe just for you, but maybe also in general from the experience you've had of teaching children. Is poetry more able to get to the heart, that core, that place where you have more rigor but also more generosity?
Well, it's nonlinear. It tends to be driven by rhythm and sound, what I'm broadly calling the music. And I think that does make it come out of a very visceral place. And you don't have to be very logical in poetry. As a matter of fact, poetry works against logic. And it's not tied to narrative, or doesn't necessarily have to be tied to narrative. Of course, there is wonderful narrative poetry. So I do think that it allows one to make all kinds of instantaneous, visceral connections that make it a very emotional medium. And it seems to be very powerful for children and people who are at risk. I mean, when I was I ran a Poets in the Schools organization, the Poetry Exchange, and it subsumed another program that I began with New York City Ballet, called the New York City Ballet Poetry Project. But part of the Poetry Exchange was a program that we ran at Creedmoor Psychiatric Institution in Queens, and my brilliant friend who was in charge of that worked with the patients there for, I guess, 3 or 4 years. And for them, too, there was some power that poetry had that I don't think you would have found in prose, because I think that you can escape the logic of narrative and linear events and get lost in the power of sound.
Now, I'm very tempted to just ask you to read right away, but I'm going to hold off for a moment because I want you to, first of all, tell for our listeners what Creedmoor was.
Creedmoor is a psychiatric institution in Queens. It's very large. I don't really know how many patients are there at the moment. I wasn't ever inside Creedmoor myself, but I think if you drove by it on one of the highways that pass it, you would see that it's a very bleak place. And people who end up there are in a lot of trouble. They don't have many resources. It's a public institution. The staff, I think, tries to do as much as they can for the patients, but it's large and personal. If someone ends up there, they're probably poor and rather friendless in the world. So it's a rough place for the patients.
And the ballet poetry, the connection between the two?
Well, I was working for New York City Ballet for many years, and I was very friendly with the head of the education department, Michelle Audette, one of the most brilliant arts educators I've ever met. And we were talking one day about the work I had done in a private school teaching poetry to children. And she said that would make a great after program for Ballet for Young People, which was a free matinee that they had for public school children every year. And so we started to develop the program, and I saw all sorts of connections between the metaphorical world of ballet and the metaphorical world of poetry. And, you know, Mallarmé once said, we use this in all of our fundraising proposals, dance is the poetry of the theater. And you know, that was our theory. But when we started the program And we went into the classrooms and connected the ballets that the children had seen with writing. It was magical. The children saw it immediately, and it led to all sorts. We brought in dance and music and art into the writing workshops, and it led to all sorts of magical connections in their work. So they seemed to, without ever having heard of Mallarmé, they seemed to have understood that connection that we conceptualized in all of our proposals about the program. It was very successful.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Catherine Levy about poetry, being a poet, and now we're going to talk about her most recent poetry volume. It's called Reports. So you said just a little while back there that poetry does better, that resonated with me after having read your poems, because it seems that there's a lot of juxtaposition of things. One expects the poem is going along in one way, and then all of a sudden the line at the end really says something quite different. So, for example, in The Garden on page 25, I'm just going to have you read it first, and then we can talk about it.
So it has as an epigraph two lines from Thomas McGrath. Thomas McGrath was a great poet whom most people don't read anymore. He was also a Marxist, and he was an activist. And the lines are, "You out there, so secret, what makes you think you're alone in the garden? The wild butterflies in the garden that can never meet for more than a second. And even then, the belief that you're crashing, locked in a lover's arms. He will protect you. You will die together." And he turns away and falls to sleep. My lost friend said, "We are never alone." He locked his door. He hid behind his books, dreaming of me, as I sit here still dreaming of him and the words he almost spoke. An imagined friend rocks me to sleep in a tower too high for the world to reach, too high to breathe or speak or caress. But I keep longing for flesh, those frantic nights, pressing my lover never closely enough, pushed onward by the fact of our love. We are deeply, deeply alone.
Right. I mean, it's really a poem about intimacy and aloneness. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about that juxtaposition.
Well, the thing that I love about writing poetry is in the process of writing the poem, you discover what you need to say. You haven't determined it beforehand. And I think that when you read poems by people who have determined it beforehand, the poetry feels dead. So I didn't know where I was going with this poem. The poem is an act of discovery. And I was certainly exploring intimacy. That epigraph of McGrath's was very important to me. The question of how you escape being alone, whether you ever escape being alone. You know, I guess I believe that we can't entirely escape being alone, even when we're most intimate with someone. And the poem is a grappling with that. But when I began the poem, I didn't know that I was going to end with, "We are deeply, deeply alone." And the paradox of the last lines for me is that it has a kind of sexual energy, that deeply, deeply alone, but at the same time, I'm talking about being alone. So it's both things at the same time. And then, you know, this is the other thing that poetry, I think, does so brilliantly when it succeeds. You can say, Frost said the poem is a way, poetry is the way of saying one thing and meaning another. So that it can have two or three or four meanings. So there's a lot of ambiguity in this poem, and it's meant to be there.
Say a little more about that.
Well, I mean, you know, you keep, for instance, the speaker says, "My lost friend said we are never alone." And later on, the speaker says, "I sit here still dreaming of him and the words he almost spoke." So did he actually speak those words, or is the speaker dreaming that he spoke those words? And there, and I think this is true of a lot of the poems in this book, and in probably in my work in general. The line between dream and reality is not clear. And I think that that's true for a lot of poetry. I think you can find it. I love Lorca's poetry, for instance. I think you can see it in a lot of Lorca's poetry. I think you can see it in Dickinson's poetry. And I think that poetry is peculiarly suited for examining that world between dream and what we call reality. And it's something I'm very interested in doing in my work.
Another thing that I noticed in this volume reports is you revisit the themes over and over again, which was interesting to me. You know, for example, you mentioned your mother, your father also, and your father's death comes up in quite a number of poems.
Yes.
Talk a little bit more about, talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you should read my first book, Losing the Moon, because I revisit my father's death even more there. I was very close to my father. He married the wrong woman. That's a mild statement. He married absolutely the wrong woman. It was a very troubled marriage. He suffered from depression, as I do. I understood him. At the same time, I was rather bitter that he didn't protect me from my mother as I felt he should have. And then he died when I was 28, before I was able to talk through these things with him. And I guess that my life in the decades since he died has been an attempt to talk through with him the things that I was never able to talk through when he was alive, and to try to figure him out, because I don't understand so many aspects of his life, of the choices that he made. And so the revisiting him in the poems is a way to, again, it's an exploration. It's a way to try to understand him, my relation to him. I guess that he was the biggest death in my life. So it's a way of trying to figure out this thing that we never really understand or come to terms with, which is death. I feel visited by his spirit frequently, whatever that means. I mean, I don't know whether I believe in ghosts or not, but as Mark Twain said, I don't believe in ghosts, but I'm afraid of them. I feel his spirit close to me. I feel his presence in me. And I guess these are the reasons I keep coming back to him and his death.
What would you say to him, or what do you say to him in your poems?
Well, I say a whole host of things because it's a complex relationship. In this previous book, I talked to him about how I forgive him for not protecting me enough. But I also want to ask him things about what his life was really like, what death is really like, what the letting go is like. I mean, there's a poem in here in which I revisit the last moments of his death. I think it's called Something to Say. And I was with him when he died. I was with him for the entire, much of the month before he died. He was too out of it for us to have these conversations that I wished we could have had. And he was very embattled because my mother made his life extremely difficult. And I watched him slipping away, and I was there at that moment when he died. And I wondered what he was feeling, what he was perceiving. He was very religious, but he did not seem to have come to terms with death at all. It was not an easy death, and it's haunted me for decades.
Can we find that poem?
Sure. And again, I had no idea when I began this poem where it was going to go. It's called Something to Say. The crows in the meadow have something to say, but not to me. The dead leaves wither all over the lawn, then blow too far away from the lawn to never be captured. A boat is unmoored. It will drift into lakes that feed into lakes, always some yards away from the shore. My father whispered, "Am I going to die?" I couldn't answer, though the ambulance sped towards his death, and I knew it, and I knew he dreaded the answer. I stroked his hand, stared at the floor. We can march like monks down to the lake to watch the leaves dissolve in the water, with nothing resolved, no harm repaired. I rushed from his room almost blind, all our stories completely undone. The friend said, at least it was painless. The doctors consoled, there was nothing to do. The rabbi at the altar chanted some prayer I couldn't decipher. I was grateful for that. Happy to meet anyone who wouldn't speak. The crows in the meadow can't care about answers. They need food, a mate, a chance to soar as high as they can over the dying, who request so little. Their rooms are locked, and every word and every movement simply hurts. Please stop this now, I thought he whispered. Or perhaps he just struggled to breathe.
So powerful. And that line, our stories completely undone.
All our stories completely undone. Mm-hmm. Well, when someone dies, the stories unravel. The stories that that person can tell are gone. They're undone. And the story, I think, that we live with, the fiction that we live with, that there's always a lot of time, that we can control things, I think that's undone. Everything, I think at those moments, if you're really someone who feels things deeply, and those of us who write poetry tend to be people who feel things deeply, I think you can feel that everything has come undone at that moment. And I certainly felt that when my father died. And my father did actually say to me, not in an ambulance, in a car going to the hospital, am I going to die? And I didn't know what to answer. And my godmother, who was the closest thing I had to a mother, died 3 months after he did. And I was determined that if she asked me that question, I would try to answer truthfully. So one day when I was helping her to eat in the hospital, she asked me the question, am I going to die? And I changed the subject.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Catherine Levy about her poetry volume, Reports. She's also the author of another book of poetry, Losing the Moon. You know, it's interesting. I'd like to tell you the story of how my mother kind of asked that question, but she asked it in a different way. She thought about death every day, probably all day of every day for the last few years of her life. And she was very disturbed that she didn't know how to die. And she was always asking me, how do I die? How can I die? And I had no answer for her. And then it was just maybe 6 weeks before she did die. And it was the 6 weeks just before she went into that kind of the last 6 weeks of one's life where you go into the hospital and then you get out and then you go back in and then you get out, that the answer came to me. And I just simply said to her, I said, Mom, we all die. We don't have to figure out how to do it. It will just happen when the time comes. And she relaxed completely.
Well, at 28, I didn't have that answer. I wasn't prepared for my world coming apart in the way that it did with my father and my godmother's death. And I didn't have an answer. And I've regretted that. My father wouldn't have been able to cope with any coherent answer, but my godmother would have. And I just didn't have it in me. I wasn't prepared for such big deaths at that point. But
oh, absolutely. And I was also stymied until finally the answer came. But I think the interesting thing is also in this book of poetry, Catherine Levy, and you're in Reports, you're also wrestling with mortality on a number of different levels, not just of your parents, but also of yourself, of aging, another theme that comes in that, you know, now you're not 28 any longer. And you're also dealing even with the larger sense of mortality that we confront these days in such a dangerous world. I wonder if you could talk about those connections.
Well, it's interesting to get older and be in a world that is feeling increasingly dangerous. I mean, I did as a child live through the Cuban Missile Crisis, so that felt quite dangerous, and it was. We came very close to apocalypse then. But I think that for those of us who were born and grew up in the post-World War II America in affluence, there was a sense of immunity and kind of an immortality, and I'm the baby boom generation, and we haven't been aging gracefully. We don't want to age. We don't believe in aging. But what has happened in particular in the 21st century is that we've had to confront a country that I think is in a world that's coming closer and closer to apocalypse. And I'm confronting that as a very politically aware person at the same time that I'm confronting I find it difficult to age. I find it difficult to accept aging. I find it difficult to accept the possibilities that are closed off, the sense that there is limited time. I'm impatient with people who want to tell nice stories about this, about how it's really liberating. I've learned so much. Well, I've learned a lot, but would I prefer to be 30? Damn sure I would prefer to be 30. There is much less of a sense of possibility, and that has gone along. And this very much comes to a head in this book, and it probably will be clearer in the next book, should I finish it. That has come to a head at the same time that we are in such a crisis in this country. I mean, I guess the country faced a crisis with September 11th, 2001, which it met in completely the wrong way, and we've just exacerbated the crisis every year, and now we are in probably the greatest crisis of all of our lives. And it goes hand in hand in my mind with my own mortality, illogically perhaps, but it does.
Yeah, and I wonder if we could read, there are a number of different poems, but you know, curiously, I actually found the poems that you've written that refer to, we call it apocalypse now, you don't say it in the poetry, but that's certainly the sense that I got. There is a curious hope, maybe more of that illogical hope. I mean, there are a number, but maybe the second one that is in the first book.
Section of Driving All Night. You have picked out one of my favorite poems in the book. And there is hope in this. It's a strange kind of hope. So it's untitled. The poems in this series involve a kind of travel that doesn't entail ever arriving anywhere. Maybe travel for the sake of travel, which perhaps is what life is about. I can travel to the crack in the world on the deck, sitting in the sunlight claiming it is safe here. No one is listening. It is better to claim when no one is listening. Think of that poet pacing along the beach, shouting to the waves, I am free, I am whole, knowing no one is listening, and plunging his fist into the air, screaming, I can make love to the sea. Cradled in the knowledge that no one is listening, that no one he needs, more than a lover, even more than the sound of his own voice. If there isn't a God, there is always the air, and the blinded birds, and the crocuses crashing. It is spring, they are crying. With no voice, we can still sing.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And also, you know, blindness, I mean, again, there's a repetition of that word and that idea throughout this book. So what is the significance of blindness in the poems?
You know, there's a Rethke line that's been quoted quite a lot in my literary circles, at least, in the past dreadful year that we've spent. And it's, in a dark time, the eye begins to see. And I mean, that's an interesting, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question about that leitmotif in this book. I think that that image relates to Rethke's line that with blindness, with poverty, with things being taken away, paradoxically, you can sometimes see better. And this is a poem of negative capability, of all the assumption, you know, Keats' notion of negative capability, the ability to be in doubts and uncertainties, I'm destroying the quote, I'm sorry, without any irritable reaching after facts. I mean, I didn't start the poem thinking it was a poem about negative capability, but when I read it, I believe that that's what it's about. You strip away things, you strip away assumptions, you strip away all of the footholds in life, the ability to see clearly. And sometimes, because you've stripped those things away, you can see more clearly. It opens doors. For me, that's what's going on in this poem.
So here's a final question. You know, in our world, there was one time, and probably for most of human literary history, poetry has been absolutely essential. And we have lost that sense. And I know that when I read poetry, which I don't do often enough, it speaks right to my heart, and I feel that it goes to the essential heart of the matter. So I want to ask you, is poetry essential?
Well, obviously, it's essential to me. I think it's essential to people. And my experience with the children and prisoners and psychiatric patients says to me that there is something fundamental that you get from poetry that you can't get from anything else, that it is so visceral. It's so much connected to the irrationality and dream world of our lives, to the way that the conscious intersects with the unconscious. I think it's essential. And let's not forget that America's a somewhat strange, isolated place. In other parts of the world, people do read poetry quite a lot. And I've often wondered why that is, as opposed to here. And I think it's because we live in a very fast-paced, product-oriented society, not a society where people are likely to sit around in a cafe and just spend some contemplative time. It's also not taught in schools. But it is essential, and I'm probably going on too long, but I was thinking today about that moment in Primo Levi's first Auschwitz memoir, which is called in America Survival in Auschwitz, but which he really wanted to be called If This Is a Man. That's what it's called in Italian. And there's the moment when he feels that he's lost his humanity, and he's dragging stones, carrying stones around with a friend of his, another Italian. And the friend wants him to explain one of the cantos from the Divine Comedy. So they begin to talk about this. And Levi says, "For a moment, I forgot. My hunger, my pain, my terror, the fact that we were under the eyes of the SS guards, I was just in that world of Dante's poetry, the beauty of the poetry, the complexity of the language." And that illustration says to me that it's essential for everyone. It's just that a lot of people don't know it.
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And before we end, I'd like you to read another poem, but I'll have to find it, because there are so many in this wonderful book, Reports, Catherine Levy, that I have my little orange tags here for. Right, and I think it's just going to be number 5 right there.
Another traveling, not necessarily arriving poem. No title again. The air is hungry. It wants your loves, your body. It wants all the years you are planning to travel, to attempt, to finally find some peace. The air wants. It doesn't care what. It wants you to float, to let go of yourself. It wants you to lie in a heap on the ground, saying, "I am sick of trying." It tries to persuade, gently as you pace on the mildest day, suddenly as you step out of your door, how could it have turned so cold? And very subtly as the lines harden in your face, your bones are crumbling, your skin collapsing, but the air needs even more. You can say, "I feel free, here up in the mountains. This air is thin. Breathing is hard. But I'm free. I feel free. Shout it. Sing it. The air won't mind. It has you. And it's not letting go.
Catherine Levy, thank you so much for coming on to Writer's Voice and talking about poetry and your poetry and reading it to us.
Thank you, Francesca. I loved your questions.
Poet Catherine Levy. In addition to reports, she's written the poetry volume Losing the Moon and A Guide for Teaching Poetry, The Nutcracker Teacher Resource Guide. She's been twice nominated for the Pushcart Prize and was a founding director of the Poetry Exchange and the New York City Ballet Poetry Project, two Poetry in the Schools organizations. Go to writersvoice.net to read some of Catherine Levy's poems. Next, poetry in performance. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This year, for the first time ever, a Pulitzer Prize was awarded to a hip-hop artist, Kendrick Lamar, for his album, Damn. Hip-hop is a form of poetry in performance. And back in 2008, I interviewed Mark Elleveld, the editor of a book and CD set about hip-hop, poetry slams, and other poetry in performance. The book is The Spoken Word Revolution Redux, and followed Elleveld's first anthology, The Spoken Word Revolution, both out from Sourcebooks Press. Let's hear an edited version of our 2008 interview with Mark Elleveld.
Today we take a look at the swelling grassroots poetry movement, a big tent under which cluster poets both of vocation and avocation, amateurs and professionals. One part of that movement is reflected by the Poetry Slam, where poets come together to compete, ringing out verses of a passionate, edgy nature. You can trace a line from the smoke-filled cafes of the beat poets of the 50s to the hip-hop poets of today. That's the kind of poetry in performance championed by my guest, Mark Elleveld. He's the author of two book and CD anthologies put out by Sourcebooks Press, The Spoken Word Revolution and its sequel, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux. In his books, Elleveld demonstrates that those who look down on poetry slams and hip-hop should take another listen. But he does more. He brings academic poets, those who publish in books, and poetry performers to joust together on the field of the spoken word. You, the listener, get to be the judge. We'll be playing cuts off the CD as we talk with Mark Elleveld about the spoken word revolution redux.
Well, Mark Elleveld, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, you're a high school English teacher. What got you interested in performance poetry and spoken poetry spoken out loud?
In 1991, I took a class with the Poetry Slam founder, Mark Smith, right outside of Chicago at a small university called Lewis University. And I'd always been interested in poetry, but the class was designed to teach the art of performance and poetry together. Fast forward to 1996-97, I start teaching English at the high school level, and we always had our poetry units, and as was the experience with my poetry in high school, if you follow the normal curriculum, it reveals great writing, but it's not always the most exciting stuff for high school students. So being around the Poetry Slam and spoken word community, I started integrating the stuff I had just via bootleg and chapbooks and recordings that I had. And it always had an immediate, direct impact of enthusiasm and excitement for the kids in the class, which also allowed me to go into some of the more classic pieces as well.
Isn't this what poetry is supposed to be? Isn't this what poetry always was? You think of the bards, you think
right.
of Homer. I mean, they didn't make a distinction between poetry and performance.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. But they were performers. I mean, in Homer's case especially, you know, go back to ancient Greece, he had a story to tell, you know, the fire, and people would sit around, and he's told these great entertaining stories of gods and love and romance and war and such. I think in the bards, they weren't afraid to entertain with their poems. They weren't afraid of a live audience. Somewhere along the way, the idea of poetry being spoken aloud as entertainment kind of got lost. And when, you know, the printing press comes out and poems start going underneath the covers of books, somehow those book things became just as important and sometimes even more so important than what poetry was doing for a live audience. To me, both have their place in the world, but for whatever reason, the performance poets were being shunned and looked down upon in a very literal world. To me, back in 1986, when the first Poetry Slam starts, that kind of starts your renaissance of the words of poetry and entertainment going hand in hand.
Yeah, you say two words there. You've got poetry and entertainment. Those are two words that often are not often paired. A lot of times, you know, poetry is seen as something that's highbrow, and entertainment is seen as something as lowbrow.
Exactly.
There's been a fair amount of controversy in the poetry world. In your book, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux, you kind of follow this controversy. Talk about the differing ideas about what poetry is or should be.
Yeah, I'm going to speak from my research on Mark Smith, who is the guy that started the Poetry Slam here in Chicago 21 years ago in July. He was an undegreed person who wrote poetry, found it a vital part of his life for expression, kind of a town hall area in his head where he was allowed to write down anything he wanted. But then he went to a lot of poetry readings, and what his experience found was that oftentimes there were professors. They had books out. It were the professor's students that showed up at the shows, and there'd be maybe 15 people in the crowd, and the professor would use a lot of probably very well-written poems, but extremely technical, and unless you had the page in front of you, oftentimes, you know, obscure in both reference, allusion, and just format. And he had gone to enough of those and said, you know, that's not the poetry that I've always enjoyed, and that's not the poetry that I want to be part of. So he decided in his head that, you know, there's a stage, there's an audience. Why disrespect the audience using stuff that you can't convey a message to? So I'm going to write, speaking as Mark Smith here, I'm going to write poems that merge performance and writing together that has an impact, a live entertainment value for the community and the audience that come to poetry readings. So, you know, it doesn't have to be that highbrow thing. It could be a community thing. It could be immediately accessible. There can be a shared expression, an idea once heard.
Now, another aspect of poetry slams per se, and this isn't just poetry slams that you're talking about here, but just to talk about that for a minute, it's a competitive form, is that right?
Yeah, it's a show. It's a show designed for an audience to hear poetry. And depending upon where you go, the seriousness of that competitive thing often varies. Here in Chicago, where it started, the competitive aspect is kind of a joke. It just builds a natural drama amongst this show idea. So at the winner, there's at random, three judges are chosen in the Chicago audience. So it could be a plumber, you know, it could be an electrician. It could, we've had Pulitzer Prize winning Chicago professors, or it could be a businessman, a student, whatever. A judge is chosen at random, and they get to choose 0 being low, 10 being high, on the worth of the performance and the poem that they hear before them. Meanwhile, the audience gets to react to both the poem on stage, and then they get to react to the judge and what the judge's opinion of that poem is. At the end of the night here at the Green Mill in Chicago, you get to win, you know, some Twinkies or $10 or a lotto ticket. So it's just kind of a joke. You know, the old saying is that the best poem always loses at the Poetry Slam. But the offshoot of that, though, is that because there's 110 or so Poetry Slam venues in the United States, and there's hundreds of them overseas now, is that you've got this real grassroots uprising, not that dissimilar from folk music or the origins of rap and hip-hop. And so they hold these competitions so that the best performance poets at each venue get together once a year at the National Poetry Slam, and there they do compete. There's 350 poets competing against each other for $3,000 or $4,000, and it's a 4-day event.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're listening to my 2008 interview with Mark Eleveld about the poetry anthology and CD set he edited, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux. Now, you've got a lot of folks who are just out of the Poetry Slam tradition and others who, well, like Mark Strand, for example, who are former poet laureates or Pulitzer Prize-winning poets. I'm thinking about the Mark Strand one, Old Man Leaves Party.
Yeah.
This is just reading a poem like many poets do, how is this something that you would put into your book as part of the revolutionary form?
Sure, yeah, great question. The first book, what I wanted to do, you know, I had a little chip on my shoulder. I wanted to say, hey, these performance poets, you know, they start on the text too, and that they write just as well as any of the academic poets that you read. Some of them are better than others, some are worse than others, but, you know, they are having their books published. They are going into second printings. They are winning awards. They are good writers. And that book was hugely successful. And the second book, what I wanted to do, and I was a little sneaky about it, to be honest with you, is that I wanted to represent all of the different people who I have seen walk in and out of poetry slams, whether or not they would admit it, which is another thing altogether, trying to get them to admit that they've been to poetry slams sometimes. In Mark Strand's case, he was at the University of Chicago for 10 years, and he did go to the Green Mill for poetry slams, and he actually ended up judging a poetry competition at the Chicago Sun-Times with Mark Smith and Reggie Gibson. So he's academic, you know, he's got all the awards and the distinctions to prove it, but he was open-minded enough where he wanted to also see what all this buzz and chatter and crowds that were going to the slam thing was as well. So in this book, like I said, I wanted to get all those people that would kind of sneak in the door to check it out, who I've seen over my lifespan at the slam. And then even more sneaky, what I did with that first section of this book is that I pretty much go poet laureate versus national poetry slam individual champion, so that you get to judge, you know, for yourself, whose work do you think is better on the page? Whose work do you hear better on the CD? Are they both good? Do we have things to learn from both of them?
Let's play two cuts from the CD to the book, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux, edited by my guest, Mark Elleveld. First, 2004 National Poetry Slam champion Sonia Renee, reading an excerpt from her winning poem, Thick.
I continue to be amazed how my curvy hips and heavy breasts manage to make men see nothing less than sex in their interactions with me. And whether summer dress cute or business suit, their eyes be watching God in my thighs. And despite my intellectual bearings, it's like men be only hearing moans and sighs. And our conversations about secret societies and presidential lies. But I know why. It's because I'm thick. Think like molasses pouring slow out of that bottle onto your mind, saturating you with poetic time, and with every word I coat your brain, yet you're still only able to watch the way I pour from that bottle. I am thick like your Aunt Sarah's pound cake. Sweet, sweet, lip-smacking sweet, and filled with so many enticing ingredients that you never bother to ask about because you only want to eat. Slow down, baby. You might be allergic to that.
Now, former U.S. Poet Laureate, Mark Strand.
Mark Strand, reading Old Man Leaves Party. It was clear when I left the party that though I was over 80, I still had a beautiful body. The moon shone down as it will on moments of deep introspection. The wind held its breath. And look, somebody left a mirror leaning against a tree. Making sure that I was alone, I took off my shirt. The flowers of bear grass nodded their moon-washed heads. I took off my pants, and the magpies circled the redwoods. Down in the valley, the creaking river was flowing once more. How strange that I should stand in the wilds alone with my body. I know what you're thinking. I was like you once. But now, with so much before me, so many emerald trees and weed-whitened fields, mountains and lakes, how could I not be only myself, this dream of flesh, from moment to moment?
Now back to our interview with Mark Elleveld. He's edited two books about performance poetry, The Spoken Word Revolution and The Spoken Word Revolution Redux. Now, you mentioned Robert Creeley, and there's a wonderful poem that you have in the book by Martina Spada. Say something about how you feel about this poem.
Yeah, when I was putting that section together, I had just read The Republic of Poetry, and I knew instantly that that was just, again, one of those jaw-dropping pieces. And I got to see Martin read, and I would say perform his own poetry. The stories that he was giving context to those poems, the honor he gave to Robert Creeley when he talked about his relationship with him prior to reading the poem. And then, you know, he's a big man. He's got that big frame and that big booming voice. And he read the piece, and it was a performance.
Here's Martín Espada talking about and reading his ode to Robert Creeley here on Writer's Voice in October of 2006.
Robert Creeley was a good friend of mine and a mentor of mine. So when he died last year, I wrote this poem for him. You got a song, man, for Robert Creeley, 1926 to 2005. You told me the son of Acton's town nurse would never cross the border into Concord, where the revolution left great houses standing on Main Street. Yet we crossed into Concord, walking through Sleepy Hollow Cemetery to greet Thoreau, his stone stamped with the word Henry, jutting like a gray thumbnail down the path from Emerson and his boulder of granite. We remembered Henry's night in jail, refusing tax for the Mexican War, and I could see you hunched with him, loaning Henry a cigarette, explaining the perpetual wink of your eye lost after the windshield burst in your boyhood face. When Emerson arrived to ask what you and Henry were doing in there, he would say, "You got a song, man, sing it. You got a bell, man, ring it." You hurried off to Henry in his cell before the trees could bring their flowers back to Sleepy Hollow. You sent your last letter months ago about the poems you could not write. No words to sing when the president swears that God breathes the psalms of armies in his ear and flags twirl by the millions to fascinate us like dogs at the dinner table. You apologize for what you could not say, as if the words of missing teeth you searched for with your tongue, and then a poem flashed across the page, breaking news of music, interrupting news of war. You got a song, man, sing it. You got a bell, man, ring it. Today you died, 2,000 miles from Sleepy Hollow, somewhere near the border with Mexico, the territory Thoreau wandered only in jailhouse sleep. Your lungs folded their wings in a land of drought and barbed wire, boxcars swaying intoxicated at 4 a.m., and unexplained lights hovering in the desert. You said, "There's a lot of places out there, friend." So you would go, smuggling a suitcase of words across every border carved by the heel of mapmakers or conquerors, because you had an all-night conversation with the world, hearing the beat of unsung poems in every voice, visiting the haunted rooms in every face. "Drive," you said, "because poets must bring the news to the next town. You got a song, man, sing it. You got a bell, man, ring it."
That's from Espada's poetry volume, The Republic of Poetry. Now, another poem I loved was one by a poet who's 93 years old. Is that right? Say something about her.
That was another mission with these books, is just to show that diversity of you know, everyone's got a poem in them. Go back to Martín's, you know, "You got a song in you, man, sing it." Everyone's got a poem, whether you're young, old, and we've got a youth section in there. The youngest poet in this book is 13 years old, and the oldest poet in the book is Elizabeth Lewis, who is now 93 years old. I came across a story about her winning a poetry slam in South Dakota. So I think she might be the oldest person to ever win a poetry slam, so I wanted to make sure I documented that.
Another thing that really struck me in this book is that I think it's not just older white guys. It's a lot of poets of color, women, much more so, I think, than perhaps you would find in a typical poetry anthology.
Thanks for saying that. I was very conscious of that. It's true. The origins of poetry slams and spoken word from 1990 to 1996, all of the national winners were all females, predominantly black. Also, contrary to that, if you go back to that first section, you know, most of the poet laureates are white old guys. So, you know, I'm not saying, but I'm saying maybe that's something that should be looked at and evaluated. Certainly, it's not just old white guys that write good poems in our country.
And it also occurs to me that, I mean, in the African-American community, you have an incredible oral tradition. You've got Gil Scott-Heron, who's been doing spoken word performance poetry since I was a kid. There's a contrast between a kind of more elitist venue for poetry, the academic one, and one that might be a little bit more democratic and a little bit more diverse.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And I think that that happens, you know, some of that might be, I don't know, I don't want to call anybody out, but some of that might be on purpose, you know? Some of that might be on purpose.
What do you mean by that?
You know, what's the intent of the individual artist? What's the intent of their art? You know, there's a place for anybody to write anything they want. I would never, ever suggest the opposite. But what is it that that artist intends to do with their work? Why do they want to put it out there? It's got to be more. I think the better artists, in my opinion, it's got to be more than they just want to see their work underneath a cover and have a couple of reviews about it. I would hope that there's something in the artist that says, you know, I think I wrote something here that's going to move some people to do something. And I think you get that in a little bit more in marginalized people a little bit.
That was Mark Eleveld. We spoke with him in 2008 about his book, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux, out from Sourcebooks Press. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the full interview. Let's go out on two-time National Slam Poetry champion Anis Mushkani performing his poem, Galumph Dies Nuts. It's in Mark Eleveld's anthology, The Spoken Word Revolution Redux. And you can also see the poet in a video performance by going to writersvoice.net.
This is called Galumph Dies Nuts. Galumph Dies Shoulders, Spines, Eyes, and Collarbones of Mine. In my underwear, I write poetry. Two-headed poetry, three-legged poetry, poetry with tin spigots and no training wheels. There are gold flames airbrushed on my ass, and I have bare feet. Bare feet. I walk with big sticks in my ears. Speak up. I am filling twigs with sentences and filing my nails with memories. My love shaves diamonds. Scientists speculate over it. I come from the moon, kneel and buzz, and the third guy walked on my tummy. I giggled, and a spoonful of cherub tasted like cherries and wallabies. I write two-headed poetry. I write two underwear poems. I take off both underwears. My poems dance around the candelabra naked in the living room. I write wrists and rubber bands on the backs of bathtubs. Press my lips to the shower's belly button and breathe. The goat man is in the woods dancing. The golden nugget. The chupacabra. The book man. There is a cloud splintering like a kneecap. Buy me pants. Buy me pants, mother. Buy me a hat. There are moths in my shoulders. I am shaking. I am full of love. I was full of love. I carved out pear-shaped slices of it and fed a million tired ankles. God sat on my shoulder like a cricket. I swatted a bee like a father's advice and asked for it again. Tell me where I can go when every bridge has wheels on it. I write poems with no training. I write my skull like it was a color I was picking up and examining. At Central Park East and 63rd Street, I clutch a football like a child and scream at a yellow wall. Go deep! Fling the big skin at the bricks, and as my childhood bounces back at me, try to snatch it in the end zone. I am the three-headed galumph, the blue giraffe, a water fountain on the moon. Catch me, carbon. Catch me, galumph. Catch me, galumph. Catcher, catch me. Catch me, Lord. I am a hill. Find my dotted lines. Hold me like a bowl, like how the clouds hold the moon, like how its arms hold the rooftops of this city that holds me and mine memories. In my veins is a lonely mermaid singing. She is singing beautifully. So beautiful she sings, sings, singy, sings. Her throat is a girl I once knew. Her nose is made of silver. Her backbone a plum. Her backbone is a plum.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.